Blog Talk Radio.
This is Port of Harlem Talk Radio, and I'm your host for this show and also publisher of Port of Harlem Magazine at portofharlem.net. If you're listening via the internet, you can type your questions in the comment box. You can also call and listen by dialing on your phone 516-531-9540. And if you want to ask a question after you are connected, press 1, and please be in a quiet place. You can also visit portofharlem.net and click Port of Harlem Talk Radio from the menu to hear this and past episodes. We're also available on about 7 podcast platforms. And lastly, We Talk Productions sponsors Port of Harlem Talk Radio. Our guest today is C.R. Gibbs, as most people who are Port of Harlem readers are familiar with. He is the author and co-author of 6 books and a frequent national and international lecturer on an array of historical topics. He has appeared several times on the History Channel and French and Belgian television and, of course, on Port of Harlem Talk Radio and his writings in Port of Harlem Magazine. Welcome back, C.R.
Oh, thank you, Brother Wayne, for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I see your in-person lecture series is back at a Woodridge Library in D.C., and I see that you did, quote, Road to Freedom, the Underground Railroad in the DMV. And for those who aren't in the DMV or don't know what DMV stands for, it stands for District, Maryland, and Virginia. However, today we're going to talk about the Underground Railroad in Illiana. And those from Illinois and Indiana, the Great Midwest, know that Illiana means Illinois and Indiana. So, C.R., I have the impression in my mind that we nationally spend a lot more time on the Underground Railroad as it operated on the Eastern Seaboard. And is that because Harriet Tubman and others like William Steele were so popular and well-known? But is that your impression or is that just my impression?
No, it's hard to get around the popularity of folk like Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman. And I think that has a lot to do with it, particularly, you know, given the size of the black populations on the East Coast as opposed to the Midwest. And that's where I kind of would like to begin. It's important that we do a little bit better in terms of teaching the Underground Railroad history than we have been doing. And when we look at the Underground Railroad in the Midwest or any other place, it's important for us to understand one thing straight off the bat. Your problems were not over once you got in the North. And when we look at the lives of black people that escaped from slavery, let's say in Kentucky or Missouri, and they got across the Ohio River and into what we'll call the old Northwest Territory, the half a dozen states or so that are Indiana, Illinois, that were part of the old Northwest Territory or Northwest Ordinance, which outlawed slavery at the beginning of this country. But unfortunately, they still did not like black folk. So if you escaped from slavery to freedom in the Midwest, you had a raft of anti-black laws you had to deal with. In Illinois, you couldn't vote. You didn't have full legal rights. And it's important, and that was not just in Illinois, but you had similar laws in Indiana and Iowa. And so these early laws either, in some cases, barred black folk or required a certificate of freedom or posting of a bond between $500 and $1,000 guaranteeing your good behavior. And that was true in Michigan as well. So once you got into the Midwest, in many ways, your problems were just beginning. You'd done the hard part, and we acknowledge that. But we don't want to do what they often do in the schools, which is you get north and all of a sudden you have whiter whites, brighter brights, and your condition is so clean you can see yourself in them.
Yeah, there's one lady who was on another talk, and I think it was something either Asala or some other group, and she talked extensively about her family being from Knox County, Indiana, and I only heard it secondhand. But so, and I will say in short, she kept saying that even when Indiana became a state, that it came in as a free state, but it took a baby maybe, she extended the time that it took for her family to be freed even after Indiana became a free state. But after I looked it up, because we had disputes about how her facts, but I would say it took Indiana at least 4 more years to make it clear that Indiana was a free state, even after it was admitted as a free state in, I think, 1819 or 1816. So, yeah, I mean, there was no idea. I can feel you in the idea that it was not a land of freedom as soon as you just crossed the Ohio River, even though we get that impression. And I grew up with that impression, Frank, to be frank with you.
Yeah, it's frustrating in a way because it oversimplifies the struggle. It oversimplifies the journey, and it oversimplifies the black people's future in the Midwest. It was not easy, and it's amazing that black people were able to achieve what they were able to achieve. And that's, of course, any place in the context of the Underground Railroad. I mean, after you've gone through swamps or hid yourself in the hulls of ships or the backs of carriages or, you know, navigated circuitous routes by using the North Star at night, these are extraordinary. And dodging professional slave catchers as well. So when I don't want, and I'm not going to go on a long thing about this, Brother Wade, but I sometimes when I talk to the children, get the sense that they think it was some kind of game, and it was not. It wasn't whack-a-mole. It wasn't find a lost penny or hide and seek
or tag
or tag. Yes, my brother, or tag. We are talking in certainly in deadly earnest, and I think it's important that when we look at this, we understand the dream of liberty that our ancestors carried. So if I could, I would just like to share a little bit of what a brother named Lewis Clark was thinking about, his worries, his fears, what went through his mind when he was about to make the break for freedom. And,
okay,
and what
so
he said.
So this
yes,
wasn't
sir.
The white Lewis, this wasn't the white Lewis Clark.
Oh no. No, this was not Lewis and Clark. This
okay.
was a brother just happened to be named Lewis Clark.
Thank you. Thank
and,
you for clarifying that.
Yes, sir. Thank you for reminding me. And he says,
okay.
I had thought long and dreamed of liberty. I was now determined to make an effort to gain it. No tongue can tell the doubt, the perplexities, the anxiety which a slave feels when making up his mind upon this subject. If he makes an effort and it is not successful, he must be laughed at by his fellows. He will be beaten unmercifully by the master and then watched and used the harder for it all his life. And then if he gets away, who, what will he find? He is ignorant of the world. All the white part of mankind that he has ever seen are enemies to him and all his kindred. How can he venture where none but white faces shall greet him? The master tells him the abolitionists decoy slaves off into free states to catch them and sell them to Louisiana or Mississippi. And if he goes to Canada, the British will put him in a mine underground with both eyes put out for life. So how does he know what or whom to believe? A horror of great darkness comes upon him, and he thinks over what might befall him. Long, very long time did I think of escaping before I made the effort. At length, the report was started that I was to be sold for Louisiana. Then I thought it was time to act. My mind was made up. So that's what it took.
Yeah, that took me in the middle. I'm sorry I almost interrupted you, but it took me – I mean, I was listening to your words. I was taken a bit away because I was like – I was building all this mistrust in myself. If I was him, I was building all this mistrust in myself to be able to leave because I wouldn't know who to trust and not even to trust myself.
Brother, I am telling you, Douglas similarly says the same thing in My Bondage and My Freedom. You know, you're torn. The freedom that what you have may not be gained. what happens then? And he had to, Douglas had to watch out. There were slave catchers after him. He was tricked, as many people were, by unscrupulous people. They had spies, what the kids called in snitches, who made money turning in other black folk. So there were, any wrong step, you could lose your life and certainly your liberty if you had been lucky enough to gain it. So, you know, it's an extraordinary risk.
So you mentioned Douglas again, and we at the top we mentioned how Douglas and Harriet Tubman and maybe even William Steele, I just added William Steele to the mix, as being mm-hmm. so overpowering that oftentimes we talk about the Underground Railroad as it functioned on the Eastern Seaboard. But are there comparable people that you could think of that operated in the Great Midwest?
Yes. I think that if we take a look, now Illinois apparently had the longest border opposite the enslaved states. And out of Illinois particularly, Chicago was a center of anti-slavery activity. And so you had people like the wealthy merchant John Jones. John Jones, extraordinary black businessman. And he went into a variety of occupations, but he never forgot his people, so that he had stuff that he kept, businesses that served as fronts for his activities on the Underground Railroad. Philo Carpenter, early black homeowners, Joseph and Anna Hudlin. And we had some fascinating white folk. A man who became president of the United States, Rutherford B. Hayes, acted as an attorney for black folk. Alan Pinkerton, the Ace Detective Agency guy, black H.O. Wagoner, who would go out west, and pastors and members of Quinn Chapel, AME, Olivet Baptist, First Presbyterian, and First Baptist Congregational Churches in and around Chicago. And again, all of this against the background of a state where black folks could not vote, could not testify, could not bring suits against whites. You could bring suits against black folk, and could not gather in groups of three or more without the risk of being jailed or beaten, and could not serve in the militia. So they were unable to bear arms or own them. And again, you had to carry that that certificate of freedom, or you could be arrested.
Okay, well, we do have time. Is any one of the people that you mentioned earlier as being comparable to Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass that you want to spend more time talking about?
I have to take note of a guy. Before we went on the air, we were talking about the statues across the Detroit River between Windsor, Ontario, Canada, and Detroit. And I would encourage our listeners, if you have the opportunity to go to Detroit, to look up the Flame of Freedom, and to go over to Windsor, Ontario, and look at the statue that is directly across the river from Detroit. And one of the people depicted on that statue, and there are several freedom seekers, but there is one individual who deserves to be much better known, a brother named George de Baptiste, and he is depicted on that statue in Detroit. And he's a guy, here we go, another local connection, because he was born in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and his family got over to Marion, Indiana, where he began to operate a barbershop that was the center of the Underground Railroad in Marion, Indiana. Now, that's about halfway between Cincinnati and Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh, that's interesting, because Marion still has a significant black population.
Yeah, okay, there we go. This guy, Brother Wayne, did everything. He loaned his certificate of freedom they say, 33 times to other people because the description was a mulatto boy, 5 feet, 7.5 inches high, 20 years of age, born mm-hmm. free. So, I mean, that really didn't tell you a whole lot.
Exactly.
So, Brother Man, yeah, he went out. He planned escapes. He assisted in escapes as well, and ultimately would become so well known that, like a lot of really successful people in the Underground Railroad, he's going to have to leave. So he would ultimately have to relocate and go somewhere else. This is the thing. I mean, I want to say a minute about the Underground Railroad codes. And one of the things I like about the Detroit area going over to Windsor is that many of the people in going across to the Underground Railroad had a code word for Detroit and the Detroit River, and the code word was midnight. So midnight in Detroit, and then the Jordan River was the Detroit River, and then one of the names for one of the freedom settlements in Canada was Dawn. So you literally could go from midnight to dawn. Midnight in Michigan, hostile to black people, and wind up in a freedom settlement called Dawn on the other side of the Detroit River, safely in Canada. So, I mean, it's these kinds of things. So the Baptiste, George the Baptiste, was one of those individuals that gave all he had to fight for his people. And again, out of his barbershop. And yes, just like in this area, folk knew what he was doing. And again, the noose tightened around him so that as he gained efficiency, as he got better and better at his job, again, he's gained notoriety and he's going to have to leave. He just got too good at what he did. And when it came to the degree of risk, he had to turn it over to somebody else.
So he's one of the people that depicted in this
in the statuary group. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
And I
agree with you. It's worth seeing. And I just want to add that the white, I forget his last name, the white, but he's a sculptor, and we did a nice interview with him some time ago, and it's on our website at Porter Column.
Oh, Ed Dwight.
Ed Dwight, that's his name.
Ed Dwight.
And he himself has an extremely interesting story.
Absolutely. I mean, we're talking about a brother who was, he got into the astronaut training program. There was tremendous pressure on Ed Dwight not to succeed.
Exactly.
Chuck Yeager, who a lot of us have heard of, was not a fan. And I'll never forget, and I won't go out long on this, but I do remember that one of his instructors said to Ed Dwight, "Why are you here? Are you a friend of John F. Kennedy? Why would a colored guy want to go into space anyway? If it was up to me, none of y'all would ever have a chance to put on the Air Force uniform." So,
yeah.
It's kind of hard to think that this guy who said this to you publicly is going to be a fair and impartial judge of your classwork. In
exactly.
fact, the odds are he ain't.
Exactly.
So,
now, my hat's all off to him, 100%. We had a wonderful interview. He once led me to the sculpture in Detroit. And just want to
mm-hmm.
add to that, another good place to go is the former places where the former slave went to in Canada, because there's still settlements there and a museum, et cetera, in Canada. And later on, we'll have to have another guest who's very much, I think she knows you. I can't remember if she said she knows you or not, but she's very much involved in Black Canadian history.
Okay. Do you recall her name?
It's on our website, and I'll think of it before we
okay.
leave. before
yeah, one
show.
Place that I've been, Amherstburg.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a small museum, and they're doing their best. This is a black museum in Canada that focuses on the communities of black folk, some who were born there and some who made the perilous trek to freedom. So it again, it's a story that is international in scope. We get caught up sometimes, you know, in a regional thing when this was an enterprise that involved black folk who went to Mexico, black folk who went to the Caribbean, and they went anywhere freedom beckoned. And
exactly.
That is the majesty of the Underground Railroad story.
And you took the thought right out of my mouth. And her name was Rosemary Sadlier.
Oh, Lord, I know Rosemary very well. Please tell her I said hello.
And she'll be on our next exhibit that we're doing for the Gambia. So that's another story at another time. But yeah, she spoke highly of you.
Yes, indeed. Rosemary was at one point head of the Ontario Black History Society. I mean, her pedigree in the community is long and distinguished, and you will enjoy talking to her. I know her personally, and she's a dedicated sister.
Yes, I think so. And we say that in the sense that these are the children of the Underground Railroad. And getting back to the Underground Railroad in particular, is there anything unique about the Underground Railroad in Illiana or even Michiana or Kentuckiana?
Well, we have to understand that the freedom seekers were not deterred. It is one thing that I would leave with the folk is if they couldn't do it one way, they tried their best to do it another. And sometimes they worked in plain sight. I'd like to share with you a very quick story about 200 miles southwest of Chicago. There was Springfield, Indiana. And Springfield, Indiana, not known for a lot of stuff, but it was the home for several years of Abraham Lincoln.
Okay.
But there was also a center on the Underground Railroad. And apparently the black folk just in Lincoln's neighborhood, if we look at just within, if the listeners would accept that any home within three blocks of your house is in your neighborhood, then Lincoln lived in an integrated neighborhood. It is believed that 14% of the black folk in his town lived within three blocks of his house, including one of the leaders of the Springfield, Illinois Underground Railroad, a brother named Jameson Jenkins, who he may have toted stuff in his wagon for Lincoln, but when he wasn't doing that, he was smuggling folk from slavery to freedom. And I wanted to just say, again, the brother's name is Jameson Jenkins, a leader of the local Underground Railroad. He had traveled with Quakers from North Carolina all the way to Indiana and then to Illinois, and he arrived in Springfield about the same time that Lincoln did. So he was one, we know of about a half a dozen folk in Springfield that worked in the Underground Railroad. And we debate today the extent. It seems unlikely that Lincoln didn't know that these black folk were doing all of this stuff around him, fighting for better schools in Springfield and all of that he was unaware of that. We know that one of his law partners subscribed to the Liberator, the abolitionist newspaper. So we have a sense of his awareness. This is not to say that he was publicly a friend of black folk, but he wasn't nasty and hostile and was known to hire black folk to work in his home. To me, is that all of this activity was going around him, and as much as they have portrayed Lincoln, Abe Lincoln of Illinois, they don't show you that this was an independent, active center for Underground Railroad activity. Springfield, Illinois, and one of the leaders was a brother named Jameson Jenkins.
Yeah, that's a whole new picture for me too. I never imagined that, and I definitely don't get that from watching television or any other show about Abraham Lincoln. But one thing I also find interesting about these places where the Underground Railroad was in the Midwest was that now a lot of these areas and towns are largely black. So you spoke with Chicago. There was Underground Railroad systems in South Chicago and the South suburbs that I'm learning more about from a group from that area. And all these towns are now majority black. And, of course, you mentioned Detroit. Springfield has a significant black population at 15%. Having a population that's 15% black in many Midwestern towns is having a lot of black people. And so the same thing with Marion, Indiana. So is there some connection you want to think of between being the Underground Railroad stop at some point, blacks feeling comfortable and staying, and now they're having a significant black population?
Well, we find that establishing a black identity, a black community, was often, not every time, but often a spur to more black folk coming to where you were, because there was still safety in numbers. There was still safety in numbers, and so you wanted to go where they at least had the makings, if you will, of a black community. And we find this time and time again. And in the decades before the Civil War, we believe that probably 3,000 to 4,500 fugitive freedom seekers came into the Chicago area. And they were able not only to join the existing black community, but also on occasion to find a handful of courageous whites that often worked with them. People still talk about the Tan family in Chicago.
I think that's the one that lived that were on the Little Calumet River.
And you said that could be. Family? Yeah, yeah. I think they were Dutch, of Dutch ancestry.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, the farm is part of a marina, a privately owned marina, but they represent those folks. And remember, you could be subject to imprisonment and a fine of up to $1,000, according to some sources, if you were effective on the Underground Railroad. So, you know, this is why we have to acknowledge that, and we also must acknowledge to our children, don't tell your kids that black people never stuck together. Don't tell your children that. The Underground Railroad, with all of its imperfections, represents a shining moment, a golden chapter in the history of black cooperation in the struggle. Doesn't have to be perfect, but we do know that when the crunch is on us, most of the time we will get our act together and we will work together.
Yes, it's the Tan family, and they were on the Calumet River, and yes, mm-hmm. they're celebrated pretty much now amongst these people who are involved in Black history and Underground Railroad in the South suburbs of Chicago, which I find so interesting now, again, that all those suburbs during white flight became white communities that black folks weren't welcome, and now there's black folks all over the place in the South suburbs. Just fascinating.
And this is, yeah, we find this in Illinois, in Indiana, suburban Chicago even. There's a college there that is believed to have been a stop on the Underground Railroad. And again, the same is true in Iowa, in Indiana, in the States. In fact, in addition to Quinn Chapel, AME Church in the Illinois, people can, there are places, the wonderful thing about this is that there are places that people can go called sacred structures that will show you the difficulty, the danger that our ancestors had to go through when they stepped out on the Underground Railroad journey.
Okay, before we close the next 60 seconds, the group in Metro Chicago, in case someone wants to get a hold of them, is called the Little Calumet River Underground Railroad Project. And, of course, they're located in South Chicago, and they have a website and a Facebook page, et cetera. So you want to end this conversation. I'm glad you also mentioned Iowa, because there's also a place on Iowa State's campus. And the years I lived in Iowa, on Iowa State's campus, no one ever told us that was an Underground Railroad place.
Well, I do want to end with an odd story out of Indiana very quickly. It's called the Hanna House, Hannah. It was believed to have been on the Underground Railroad, the people who lost their lives are still believed to haunt this house, this stop on the Underground Railroad. That's what they tell me locally.
Okay.
I mean, we know that these kinds of places, we have well-known people like Levi Coffin and everything, but we want to acknowledge black folk because they were the main risk takers. They had far more to lose, and yet those kinds of obstacles did not make their courage flag. They kept on pressing on.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Brother Gibbs, and I feel so much better, so much more smarter, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Brother Wayne. I look forward to our next confabulation.
All right. Everybody, thank you for listening, and don't forget to like us on Facebook and visit us at portofharlem.net. Have a great day.
Thank you, bro. Goodbye.
Take care.